Members, I call the meeting of the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Division to order. We will begin with the approval of the minutes. Representative Carlson moves to amend or to approve the minutes from April 11th, 2018. Any additions, corrections, or other discussion on the minutes as presented? Hearing none, all in favor of approving the minutes from April 11th, 2018, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Minutes are approved. We'll begin with Representative Nornes. He's got a testifier coming from 4 hours away. And Bill Authors, if you're from a long ways away, if you would talk to Lucas here, the committee legislative assistant, we want to start with the people from furthest away first, if we can. And so we'll start with Representative Nornes. Representative New moves that the committee entertain House File 2754 and then it be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome to the Property Tax Committee, Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for allowing us to be first on the agenda. Members, House File 2754 allows the city of Perm, which is in my district, to impose up to a half-cent sales tax, one-half of 1% local sales tax, if approved by the voters in the 2018 general election. It requires the city to use the sales tax revenue to fund the Perm Area Community Center that is kind of referred to as the hub, I think is the name for it. It's the old high school. It allows the city to issue up to $8 million in bonds for the project, and those bonds would not count against the city debt limit. And the other thing is to point out that it requires the tax to expire in no later than 25 years. I think that pretty well covers the bill itself. We have with us Jonathan Smith, the city manager from Perm, and I think he has probably some additional comments that he can make.
Thank you, Representative Nornes. Please introduce yourself, sir, for the record, and proceed.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jonathan Smith, city manager, city of Perm. Thanks again for having us and getting us kind of bumped up. It is great travel weather at this point, so we're good. We're fortunate for that. As I hope you're all aware, the city of Perm is a thriving community in West Central part of the state. We're home to some of the very well-known snack and pet food businesses and industries. Barrel of Fun Potato Chips, Wiley Wallaby Licorice, Tuffy's Pet Foods, Bongard's Cheese, you name it. Perm is also home to about 3,300 residents within our city limits. These residents, as in many other communities, choose to live here because of the deep-rooted passion that they have instilled in this great community. As we are very similar to other communities, mainly the larger ones, larger than us, we are very different. We have over 4,400 jobs in our community. So that's 1,100 people that we have to input into our community more than what our actual population is. So because of that, we also bring in, according to the 2015 deed report, we actually have about 3,000 people commuting into our community daily for work. So right there just basically doubles our population. Every day. So just because our population itself is 3,300 with those additional jobs, it bumps that up significantly. There's no doubt that our industry thrives, and we're very thankful for that. It's a big part of our community and our economy. Another big part of that is our tourism. Being located in the highest lake-populated county in the nation, you can imagine the impact tourism and our seasonal residents have on us. Perm has several populated lakes within a close radius to us. These lakes are populated because they equate to 6,600 homes, both residential and both year-round and seasonal homes. So an additional 6,600 homes within 15-mile radius dramatically increases our in-town population throughout the day. Although, you know, it's an estimate of how many people actually come throughout the weeks and days, in the summer, from June to August, every Wednesday, we have over 400 children that come Wednesday mornings to race turtles. We're the home of the international turtle races. So imagine 400 kids every Wednesday morning coming in and racing turtles. So it's a pretty big economic development tool for us to race turtles. So we're actually celebrating our 40th anniversary of turtle races in the city of Perm this year. So we're pretty proud of that. It's a pretty cool thing. Very unconventional, if you will, for economic development. We've actually had representation from 50 states and over 20 countries participate in our international turtle races. So how does this all relate to why we're here today? As you can see, Perm is way more than 3,300 residents that live in our community. We are a region of people that have come together to grow and love our community, a community that has, over the past 40 years, come together to raise funds for things they believe in. It has been very seldom that we have come to the state to ask for any type of support. But today we're here to ask for the approval to authorize a local option sales tax. This local option sales tax, along with some state bonding dollars, we will be able to create, expand, and explore greater opportunities for our regional communities. These opportunities will allow our region to have greater access to resources to grow healthy and well-balanced families. The project associated with the sales tax will host multiple organizations that will aid and assist with family and wellness. These organizations, most are currently in operation looking to expand, offer services for children, autism diagnosis and development, physical and mentally disabled, workforce readiness, community theater, art, and history, along with countless other indirect benefits. Emily Dreyer, the project coordinator for this, is here to tell you a little bit more specifics about that project and how that impact is going to be on our region.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Welcome, Ms. Dreyer. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Emily Dreyer, and I'm the project coordinator for the HUB project, which is also the Perm Area Family and Wellness Center. This project addresses a number of needs within the city of Perm, but also within the greater region. This is a long-term, comprehensive solution to combat many issues facing rural Minnesota today. As Jonathan mentioned, solutions to help with childcare, individuals with autism or other disabilities, and our workforce are major concerns for us. We want our residents leading successful, contributing lifestyles that are centered around family. To accomplish this, it takes a village of like-minded individuals and to get things done, and we are lucky to have that in Perm. Many of these programs are already operating. We just need more space to foster their growth. Workforce training is a component of our plan. We intend to use the newly repurposed building to train the next generation of workers using a vocational training on the fly certificate model, as well as continued collaboration with local technical colleges. Currently, we have a model training program that links manufacturing, equipment, and on-site industry expert trainers into our high school. Programs right now include Kitmaster's metal lathe and KLN mechatronics trainers. Another portion of the workforce training plan involves Productive Alternatives. Productive Alternatives is an agency providing diverse human services programming, including workforce placement and training for persons with disabilities. PA is used to operate on the model of bringing work to the individuals, but recently switched to placing individuals with differing abilities into the workforce. These individuals are filling the much-needed gaps in our workforce, while also showing all of us that there's a place for everyone and sending a message of acceptance. A major concern of our workforce is childcare. We partnered with First Children's Finance on a gap analysis of the supply and demand of childcare in our area. And just this week, we were shocked to find out that within a 30-mile radius, there are over 1,100 needed childcare slots. The presenter said there's typically a couple communities that have a surplus of slots, but there was not a single community within 30 miles that had enough care. She had never seen that before. It is a problem and one we need to tackle as a community. This facility has the potential to house a program that would provide space for unique and innovative childcare programs that would help erase some of that gap. Industries and employers in our area are especially interested in coming up with solutions that take on sick, infant, and 24/7 child care because we are a community that works around the clock. Which brings us to our future leaders. Our Boys and Girls Club has grown by 500% since 2011. Because of this growth, members are currently split between two sites. With expanded space, they could bring all students under one roof and also serve an additional 100 to 150 youth. There are families that have been on a waiting list for over 7 months to be part of the club. The club isn't just an outside of school care for students. They work on students' qualities such as respect, leadership, and more through partnerships with local organizations. The growth of the Boys and Girls Club has added over 100 kids to our local 4-H club, which has even prompted Ottertail County to hire an additional 4-H program coordinator. Moving forward, a focus of the club is growing their youth population in the ages of 11 to 18 years old, which is the age when kids typically fall off the wagon. Keeping these kids on the right path will save millions in human services programs over the course of their lifetimes. Another program that could save millions of dollars in human service programming is Empowering Kids. It is a relatively new nonprofit organization that focuses on providing programming support and resources to families and individuals with autism, ADHD, and other social cognitive challenges. For example, a parent came to Empowering Kids because her son struggled with people coming over to their house. He would throw a wild tantrum and even curse at them to leave. One of our teachers was able to go out to the house and work with this parent to write a social narrative about how this little boy should react when people came to his house. The mother read this narrative to the boy multiple times a day. Our teacher was going to practice with him and came over to the house, but his grandpa came over before that happened. The mother was a little nervous about this, but the boy typically would throw things at his grandpa and tell him to go away. But after working on the social narrative, the boy pleasantly greeted his grandfather and then went to play in the next room. This is just a small example of the impact that this organization can have on individuals, as well as their parents, loved ones, communities, and more. Expanding into the repurposed facility will allow Empowering Kids to become a regional support center for families and individuals of all ages, helping empower these students and individuals to find their passion and shine will give them confidence, social skills, training, and more to join the workforce and live a life of hope, dignity, and happiness. All in all, the facility will not only allow these current programs extra space to grow and expand, but also allow them to share resources and collaborate with each other. This model of our Family Services Center will allow our organizations to provide the best services for our region. It is one of the first of its kind, and it will become a model for other communities across the state. This facility will not only have an impact locally. We believe that addressing the needs of our people today will serve our city, county, state, and taxpayers millions of dollars into the future. The impact on society would be far-reaching. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dreyer. Questions for Mr. Smith or Ms. Dreyer members? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Asking if you plan on, if you can say at this point, if you keep the tax in effect for 25 years or until you raise the $8 million goal.
Yeah.
Mr. Smith?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The plan would be hopefully we'd raise that $8 million before the 25-year period based off of estimates from the Department of Revenue. So did I answer?
And then you'd take the tax away?
Yes.
Okay. Yep. Then just one quick follow-up again. If you're going to tax for $8 million and issue $8 million in bonds, how are you going to service the debt?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative, the debt would be serviced through that sales tax revenue. So that half cent or the half of 1% would be we'd pay that back over that 20. Basically, we're hoping on 20 years. So we take out a 20-year bond, and over those years with that revenue that comes in, we'd pay off that bond.
Representative Anderson.
But if you're going to issue $8 million in bonds mm-hmm. and take in $8 million, those two kind of balance each other.
Right.
And the debt service is additional, then, correct?
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, yeah, so they balance each other out. So that revenue will pay off that debt service, basically. There's obviously some interest there. And so, again, we're hoping that the overall project, at this point, you know, it's still kind of preliminary, that the overall project will come in less than that, and then that $8 million will be sufficient to pay both the debt service and the interest associated with that.
Okay, other questions, members? Anyone else who would like to testify on the bill? Hearing none, Representative Dornis, any closing comments?
I just want to thank you for giving the time to my one of my cities. It's a great place to visit. Plan a vacation sometime. Come on up there. That's all I have to say. Next November is when this election would take place.
Sounds great. Thank you for coming, and have a safe trip home.
Thank you.
With that, Representative New renews her motion that House File 2754 be laid over, and that House File is laid over. Next, we'll have Representative Sundin. House File 3068, Representative Loeffler moves that the committee entertain House File 3086 and that it be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Sundin, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3086 is something that's necessary for the city of Cloquet to fully utilize the sales tax that was authorized a few years back. I'll give you a little bit of background on this, and then I'll turn over some of the comments to City Councilor Dave Bierkness and City Manager Aaron Reeves here as well. So a little bit of background. House File 3086 is designed to provide the City of Cloquet with flexibility to spend sales tax dollars on its existing approved uses. The city of Cloquet worked with the legislature for a long period of time before its local option sales tax was approved by the legislature in 2011. And then by over 63% of the Cloquet voters in the 2012 ballot. The city invested significant time and effort into honing the authorized uses of the tax proceeds to make the most effective use of taxpayers' dollars. Three uses were ultimately approved, $4.5 million for park improvements, community facilities, and development of pedestrian trails, $5.8 million for utilities and improvements related to the development of certain property adjacent to Highway 33 and Interstate 35, $6.2 million for engineering and construction of infrastructure improvements, including storm sewer, sanitary sewer, and water. And Councillor Dave Bjerknes will continue on the need for this bill.
Good evening.
Thank you. Councilmember Bjerknes, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, thank
you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is David Bjerknes, and I've served on the Cloquet City Council now for 18 years. So I've been involved in this Cloquet sales tax issue for about 15 of those years, from its inception through its passage ultimately in 2012. The need for flexibility, that's really what we're asking for this evening. As Mr. Sundin indicated, there are three authorized uses for the sales tax dollars, and specific dollar figures were associated with those uses. Unfortunately, despite the time and consideration the city gave to putting and crafting those uses together, the Highway 33 development has proven to be unfeasible. And this is primarily due to three reasons. We've encountered poor soils conditions on much of the site that cannot be easily mitigated or financially would be a burden to mitigate them. The cost to relocate a pipeline is required and has proved to be much more costly than was originally anticipated when the tax bill was adopted. Despite considerable effort by the city, site viability and, as important, market conditions make the development of the site nearly unfeasible. There is a portion of the site that is still developable. It's a much smaller portion, portion of the original property, and the required investment will be considerably less. What the bill does, well, it doesn't do certain things. It does not change the amount of money the city will collect under its current sales tax legislation. It does not modify or add to the three approved uses for the sales tax. Rather, it allows the city flexibility in light of unforeseen circumstances, which couldn't be predicted when the legislation was passed. This bill would allow any amount the city is unable to spend on the development of the Highway 33 property to be spent on the other approved uses. This allows the city to continue exploring opportunities to develop that site and would provide the flexibility to use the revenue for other approved uses. So with that, I'll send it to you for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bjerknes. Mr. Reeves, are long for support. Thank you. How are you, sir?
Good. How are you?
Good to see you. Any questions, members? Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, was this originally put to the voters with these specific parameters in place?
Mr. Reeves?
Sure.
Please introduce yourself, Mr. Reeves.
Sure, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Aaron Reeves, City Administrator. So, Mr. Chair, Representative, the wording for the sales tax did not include specific uses. Actually, the exact wording was, shall the City of Cloquet, Minnesota, the city, be authorized to impose a sales and use tax of 0.5% to finance the cost of improvements to city parks, trails, and recreation areas, and street and utility infrastructure. That was the wording. So that was what was approved by the voters, and then when it was here at the legislature, that's where it was requested to be more specific, and that's how it eventually got into the actually approved sales tax bill.
Representative New?
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Representative Hertos?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, officials from the city of Cloquet. What was the original appropriation amount in the first time you got this approved? Did you have a limit before? I see it's now 16 and a half million. Was there a smaller amount first time around?
Mr. Reeves?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. No, this is the same amount. We're not asking for any more sales tax. It's just simply that one identified amount of $5.8 million. We want to be able to use it for the other two approved uses if we can't use that full amount here, which we anticipate we will not be able to. So we're looking for some flexibility, but does not increase the approved amount originally.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Representative Sundin, any closing comments?
This is a terrific bill. Thank you, Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Sundin, for your brevity. Representative Loeffler renews her motion that House File 3086 be laid over for possible inclusion in House Files laid over. Thank you. Have a safe trip home, folks. Representative Murphy, are you here? Okay. Representative Nelson moves that the committee entertain House File 4034 and that it be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I have with me tonight Mayor Chris Swanson from Two Harbors and Councillor Kathy Erickson from Two Harbors. House File 4034 is a bill that would expand the sales tax for Two Harbors and allow them to bond for emergency sewer repair or water repairs, and that they could pay off the debt. And Mayor Swanson will tell us about the need for this bill and why they're asking.
Representative Murphy, there is an A1 amendment for the bill, and you'd like that moved forward. Is that correct?
I really would.
Okay. with that, Representative Nelson moves the adoption of the A1 amendment. Discussion on the A1 amendment. Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. A1 is adopted. And your testifiers, Representative Murphy, I heard the names, Mr. Swanson and Ms. Erickson. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Who's going to go first? Mr. Swanson, welcome. Yep. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. I'm Chris Swanson, Mayor of Two Harbors, and I just want to thank you for your time. Mr. Chair and committee members, usually when I'm out and about in the state and I start talking about Two Harbors, I usually hear a couple things. One, you either honeymoon there, vacation there, or most likely you ate at Betty's Pies there. So we love the North Shore. Lately, Castle Danger Brewery has been making the headlines, wonderful beer. So I would like to thank Representative Murphy for authorizing this bill and supporting the request being brought to you today. We've been working in Two Harbors on our infrastructure. We have what's called a capital improvement plan. I'm sure many of you are familiar with those. It is something that's very near and dear to our hearts and our community as well. And what we've been doing is working extremely hard to make sure that we can get dollars together for the expensive infrastructure that we need repaired. In doing the study for our capital improvement plan, we found out that Two Harbors has 64 miles of roads. Underneath those roads, of course, are water, sewer, and all the other infrastructure that needs to be repaired. One of the things that we found out about being in Two Harbors is that we're right on Lake Superior, and we get held to a good standard in terms of making sure our infrastructure is top-notch. Basically, in order to repair the facilities that we're talking about after our engineer estimates, we're looking at $61 million, and that breaks down to about $22 million for city underground sanitary sewer infrastructure, $26 million for improvements to the city's underground water infrastructure, and $13 million for improvements to the city's underground storm sewer infrastructure. For 2018, we have just under $500,000 infrastructure cost underneath the additional planned surface work. That combined is being projected to cost just about $1.7 million just this year alone. Two Harbors is a town of about 3,600 people with about 1,650 households, which is, as you can imagine, a lot of money for a small town on the North Shore. We've done a lot of research. We've talked to our community members. We've spoken with the Chamber of Commerce, who unanimously provided us a letter of support saying that this 0.5% makes a lot of sense to get our infrastructure repaired. The community has given us a lot of support. They'd like us to bring this to referendum this fall, much like Perham is asking for as well. That being said, the other thing that we're faced with, I'll just share with you in the very near future for infrastructure, is a sewer plant that our engineers are estimating is going to be between $12 million and $18 million on our early estimation. That initial plant was built in the 1950s, so a lot going on infrastructure-wise. That plant, of course, is very important to Castle Danger Brewery. They as well are supportive of this project. House File 4034 is critical to Two Harbors and to our capital improvement plan, and we ask for your support. It would be greatly appreciated. And I'm willing to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Welcome, Ms. Erickson. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Kathy Erickson. I'm a city councilor.
Can we move your – there we go. Move right in there, Ms. Erickson.
My name is Kathy Erickson. I'm a city councilor for the city of Two Harbors. And echoing what the mayor said, I just wanted to let all of you know that we spent a lot of time looking at how we could finance these projects. What we came up with at the end was that we were going to have a moderate tax levy increase every year since we're starting our first rollout of the projects in 2018. We are doing the assessment policy under the 429 process, so all of our affected homeowners will be doing the assessment policy. We are doing transfers from several funds to help fund the current year $1.7 million. And then finally, after we looked at the costs and looked at that we still had a gap, was only then that we looked at the possible local option sales tax. So the city is looking at every single funding option that we have to help cover these projects. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, members? Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question would relate to subdivision 5 in the lines 3.8 through 3.15. I notice that you've got 25 years and $30 million. I guess with regard to the language that allows you to deposit the extra funds in the general fund of the city, my concern would be, or maybe you could clarify for me, if hypothetically you were collecting $1 million a year, or let's say $1.5 million a year over 25 years, but your debt service only required you to be paying $1 million a year to service the bond debt. And those numbers don't mathematically work, but I'm curious if you're able to put a little residual every year into the general fund and under this language would permit you to spend it on other causes.
We'll go to Ms. Swanson. Maybe Ms. Dalton can help, and then Ms. Swanson, will that work? Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertaus. The language that you're seeing there is actually standard language because we can only end local sales taxes at the end of a calendar quarter. Okay. And because of that, there's got to be some place to put that little residual. But this would not allow them to take a little money every year off the top and put it into their general fund.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hertaus, that's it?
That's it. Thanks.
Okay. Other questions, members? Okay, one item, Representative Murphy, there's a blank on 1.17, and I'm expecting the hope it there would that would be 2019. Does that work? So it would be in an election held before 2019?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the mayor said that the constituents of Two Harbors want it in November of 2018.
Okay, so
the referendum.
Okay, so Representative Nelson moves to amend House File 4034, if that's okay, Representative Nelson, by inserting in the blank on 1.17 the numbers 2019.
That's my amendment, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Nelson. Discussion, members? Hearing none, all in favor of inserting the year 2019 and the blank on 1.17, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The bill is amended. Other questions, members, for either Mr. Swanson or Ms. Erickson or the author? Okay. Closing comments, Representative Murphy.
Well, thank you, Representative Nelson. Thank you, members of the committee. We appreciate your attention.
Thank you so much. Have a safe trip home, everyone. Thank you for your presentation here today.
Two hours anytime.
We'll be up for pie. Okay, so with that, Representative Nelson renews his motion. The House File 4034, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. And the House file is laid over. Okay, who's the next furthest away? We will see who steps forward here. Is Representative Hamilton here? Representative Hamilton has a testifier, and I think they're a ways away. Oh, and Representative Schultz. Representative Schultz, you're next, if that's okay?
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Hamilton, we're digging for your bill here. We're going to get it moved before us. Representative Rarick moves that the committee entertain House File 2663, and that will be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And there is an amendment to get the bill in the shape that I'd like to present it, Mr. Chairman, the A1 amendment.
Thank you.
And if I could speak to that, Mr. Chairman.
You could. Let's move it first, Representative Hamilton. Representative Rarick moves adoption of the A1 amendment. And Representative Hamilton, if you would explain, that would be awesome.
And, Mr. Chairman, this bill, I believe, was actually dropped last year, and it's just bringing it into 2018. I ask for your support.
Okay, thank you. Discussion, members, on A1 as presented and described. Hearing none, all in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill actually was brought to me from the League of Minnesota Cities, and basically you're looking at just a general framework for local option sales tax for communities all across the state. We've heard a number of these coming forward, as you are listening to here today. And if you look, it would be specific to, they would need a voter referendum for specific allowable uses are listed under, on page 3, excuse me. And then there would be a limit as far as their expiration would be once the dollars were actually collected for the project and or it, we put in here 20 years. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I do have a testifier, Mr. Steve Nasby from the City of Windham, and I'd like to turn it over to him at this time.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Nasby, if you would introduce yourself, sir, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Nasby, City of Windham, City Administrator. Thank you again for the opportunity to come tonight. Chair Drazkowski and members. I'm here today to represent the League of Minnesota Cities to support House File 2663. A bill which would allow cities to enact a local option sales tax without legislative approval as long as the sales tax fits within the pre-established process framework that's already in place. This bill has grown out of discussions that the League has had on the policy committee level. I believe it was Fiscal Futures has had this policy for or policy position for a number of years. There's been a lot of cities that have come here and asked for local option sales tax approvals. Most of those have been approved by the legislature. A lot of them haven't. But the ones that have been approved, most of the local option sales tax are for types of capital projects that are specified within the bill Representative Hamilton has drafted. Most of the requests are for up to 0.5% local option sales tax. And most of the requests are for bonding authority to support that sales tax, to be supported by that sales tax revenue. City officials have previously sought local option sales tax authority also identified challenges in the current law and the process. And I'm a poster child for that. I think I was here three different times with Wyndham's local option sales tax. Some of those process challenges have been the time commitment to navigate the legislative process. The friends from Perham and Two Harbors that were already here this evening, and I'm here from Wyndham. It's a long drive for us to get here, and multiple hearings, but we do appreciate the opportunity to come here. There's the unpredictability of legislative action. Sometimes it's unclear or unrelated to the specific request. Sometimes it's the failure of the governor and the legislature to agree on a bill. That happened to one of my local option sales tax bills in the previous session. But the nature of the part-time legislative session also delays some local projects. Trying to have the local option sales tax at a general election, so in our case, it'd be November of 2018, we would come to the legislature in your 19th session, which would get over approximately May or June. And then you have to give 90 days notice to the Department of Revenue before they can enact the sales tax. You're already to September. So for a city, we've lost that construction season. So even though the voters would approve it in November of 18, it'd be probably a 2020 start. So you can see that there's significant delay in that process. Under current law, the city council must adopt a resolution to enact sales tax, specifying the proposed rate, expected revenues raised, the uses of the tax, and the expected sunset. They also have to receive voter approval at a general election. Can't be a special election called. It has to be a general. They receive approval by the legislature through special legislation, such as being sought this evening. They need to comply with Minnesota statutes 645.021 to approve special legislation and file compliance with Secretary of State, adopt enacting ordinances, and notify the Commissioner of Revenue. As I noted, that's 90 days prior to. So you can see there's quite a bit of work that has to be done to that. Representative Hamilton's talked about the allowable uses for this. The bill would also permit cities to use bonds to pay for the sales tax to support the general obligation bond. So we would urge you to support House File 2663 and include it in the Property Tax Local Government Finance Division report. Mr. Gary Carlson from the League of Minnesota Cities is here to help us with any technical questions you may have for this evening.
Thank you, Mr. Ransky. Thank you. Mr. Carlson, would you like to speak on the bill or just be a resource?
I'm just a resource.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Questions, members? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I understand this correctly, instead of having all these cities traipse here to our committee asking for their specific one, this would give a general permission so that anyone could do this, but they'd have to follow the steps that they already have to follow. It's only taken out the step of having to come here and specifically ask for Wyndham, Two Harbors, whatever city's out there.
That's what I understand. Representative Hamilton.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Nelson. Yes, that is correct.
Other questions, members? Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarifying question. For existing local option sales tax, like we just heard about for Cloquet, House File 3086, where they have it all set up and everything, they just want to make some changes within the existing parameters, would they still have to come to the legislature to do that, or could that be done more on the local level?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill doesn't have any provision for somebody coming in and altering an existing tax, so they would still have to come in front of the legislature or something like that.
And that would have been a special law, Ms. Dalton, too, right? So it's specific. Okay. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I'm someone who likes these meetings just because I get to learn about all kinds of interesting projects that are happening in other parts of the state and the creativity of local governments. At the same time, I mean, I'm really torn because I really see where for cities this just really streamlines the process and allows them to step forward. We had a discussion earlier in this committee about, are the local option sales taxes really were started up as a way to help regional centers get some resources in from people who really rely on them, because that's where the commercial area of that is in that particular group of geography, or that's where the one library is that's used by people in a bunch of surrounding small cities. And so they have some extra, because they're a regional center, they have some extra burdens, and it was a way to get the users to help contribute. Now we're seeing more and more proposals that are really more local projects focused mainly on benefiting that city, which has kind of been an evolving change. And I think we just need to kind of wrestle with, where do we want this to go? Because this would clearly allow everyone to use it as just another new revenue source, another tool in the revenue-raising toolkit. But it may make it more difficult for those regional centers then to have something to counteract those. Or they'll change. Instead of supporting the regional facility, using the money for the regional library, for example, they might instead say, well, we're going to use it for our sewer project to reduce the cost for our residents. So we just need to think a little bit about how would this play out long term. I have no opposition to getting rid of the process kind of hurdles that we've created. I'm just thinking we need to think through about, does this change sort of the mix of those regional centers, and do we need to think about something else for them then?
Thank you, Representative Hamilton.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the thoughtful discussion and dialogue. I mean, there's one community in the district in which I represent who is trying to find the funding for a fire hall. Theirs is pretty outdated, and I know the equipment, the modern equipment that they've been purchasing, they're having a difficult time even getting that to fit in their fire hall, right? To the point where if it snows, they have to be out there chopping ice so that the fire truck, when it goes out the door, it doesn't hit the top. I mean, that's a serious issue, right? But the problem is they can't raise the money. And I've actually carried bonding proposals to try to get some additional funding back for capital investment to help them build that fire hall because they don't have the money. And they are a recipient of LGA, right? They are a recipient, but they just don't have the money for that capital expense. And so do you either lay off all your firefighters so you can build a fire hall, invest the money there, or, you know, where's that balance? And so that's where we're saying in some of these specific examples, and that's why we clearly laid them out here, to where you give the community that additional tool, I think you said. You give them that additional tool. But the other thing we want to stress, it has to be voter approval. And if the voters say absolutely not, well, then you're going to have to, you know, look for other ways or just scrap the program. But I appreciate the thoughtful dialogue. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just thinking out loud given the discussion we had earlier about how does this work and does it change the incentives to meet regional needs, and do we need to look at new tools for that then?
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'll do my annual concern about local option sales taxes, and I have nothing against this bill personally. But again, what I think we're doing here is creating winners and losers. A lot of our small towns or smaller counties don't have the retail base to really raise enough to make a local option sales tax viable. And the regional centers can do that very well in a lot of our counties and towns. But again, I just have the concern that when we start relying on these local option sales taxes, we are allowing winners and losers in terms of who can increase these funds or raise these funds, and our smaller governments can't because they don't have the retail infrastructure to make a sales tax viable and raise enough to make it worthwhile. But that's my annual rant about this.
He's got it in there. All right. Anybody else? Any other questions? Representative New.
I'm sorry, I'm furiously reading, but perhaps if I just ask the question, you'll know the answer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is on the wording that it is a city or group of cities acting under a joint powers agreement, and I, like I said, I haven't gotten to that point in reading the bill. But if it is a group of cities under a joint powers agreement, does that voter approval have to occur in each city, or can one city have the tax imposed if two other cities vote in favor of the tax? Does that make sense?
Ms. Dalton's got the answer.
Great, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, each city would have to vote to be part of it, and they wouldn't become part of the joint powers if that city voters didn't approve the election. This is very similar to what's going on in the St. Cloud area right now. There's a central Minnesota sales tax. It includes St. Cloud. It includes Wake Park, St. Augusta, Sartell, St. Joseph. Wake Park. I think I've got all of them. But some of them actually joined 2 years after the other ones first voted because it did not pass in two of the cities. And so they were not part of the original joint powers agreement, but then later on they passed they got voter approval and joined at a later date. So that would be allowed under this, but no. St. Cloud couldn't be a part of a joint powers agreement and impose it in all six of the communities because their population overwhelmingly voted for it and the rest of them didn't.
Representative?
Thank you.
So how would that happen mechanically, Ms. Dalton? So so if you got three communities and they're located in one little triad, would each of the city councils decide they're going to go into a joint powers and then they would or potentially a joint powers, and then they would pass the referendums in the respective ones and then somehow get back together again and say, okay, they all passed. How does that play out? Or maybe Mr. Carlson knows or something. I don't know. Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, and as I said, I think probably the best is the Central Minnesota group that actually did it. And they essentially had an agreement to join a joint powers if they could get their voters to approve them imposing the sales tax. And so they each passed an individual resolution, and then they each held an individual election. And as I said, two of the cities, it didn't pass. And so they started the joint powers with the original, the four where it did pass, and then they added two over the years.
Okay. Other questions, members? Thank you. Okay. Representative Hamilton, closing comments.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I just want to say once again thank you for the thoughtful dialogue and the consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Nasby as well, and Mr. Carlson for your help. Representative Rarick renews his motion that House File 2663 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion. The House file is laid over. Representative Schultz is next. Representative Joachim moves that the committee entertain House File 3006 and then lay it over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Schultz.
Thank you. Members and Mr. Chair of the committee, House File 3006 seeks approval for the City of Duluth to issue a 0.5% sales and use tax dedicated for city street maintenance. The city put this sales tax question to the voters on November 7th of last fall, and the referendum question was overwhelmingly approved by the citizens of Duluth, and I believe in your packet you have the results of the vote. It approved by 76.52%, and that may be the highest approval rating for a sales tax referendum, but we have to check on that. So I have with me David Montgomery. He's the Chief Administrative Officer of the city, and he's going to describe why we need to have dedicated revenue for our streets.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Montgomery. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, sir, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Montgomery. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer of the City of Duluth. Mayor Larson sends her regrets that she couldn't be here, but she had to be at the groundbreaking for our Superior Street project that kicks off today. We appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3006. As many of you know, Duluth is a beautiful place. But it was built on a 700-foot hill in very inhospitable climate with poor soils, which makes for faster-than-usual deterioration of our infrastructure. The city is also pretty old. Some of our infrastructure dates back over 100 years. And our streets stretch for 26 miles from the Fond du Lac neighborhood near the entry to Jay Cook State Park to the Lester Park neighborhood well up the north shore of Lake Superior. We have nearly 400 miles of roads in Duluth that we are responsible for. That's a state worth of roads. State of Minnesota is 405 miles north to south. Our streets are in terrible shape. People joke that the only people happy with the condition of our Duluth streets are the auto repair shops. The only thing everyone in Duluth, including our visitors, agree on is the atrocious condition of our streets. As Representative Schultz mentioned, the revenue from this half-cent sales tax would be fully dedicated to the streets program. We have an engineering plan that identifies the projects across the city that would be addressed over the course of the next several years. As Representative Schultz mentioned, Duluth voters overwhelmingly support this dedicated funding mechanism. The referendum results of last November's election voiced a clear and decisive message. The voters approved the referendum question with a vote of over 76.5% in favor. And in fact, voters in every single precinct approved this referendum. We request your favorable consideration of this proposal. We're not asking for state funding. We are simply asking that you endorse our citizens' desire to raise the funds locally and fix our streets. We will put these funds to good use, repairing Duluth streets up and down our hillside. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Montgomery. Members' questions for Mr. Montgomery, the author. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the fiscal or the House research memo, I'm not sure if it's a fiscal note, it says the extra half-cent tax terminates at the earlier of 25 years or when the City Council determines that sufficient revenues have been raised. Do you have a sense of what the projects that you've presented in this packet would actually cost overall?
Mr. Montgomery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Barr. The total package of streets and the condition of our roads that we would actually be able to do far exceed the amount of money that this would raise. This bill would raise approximately $7 million a year. So over the 25 years, it would be approximately $175 million. We have well over $300 million worth of projects if we did every single street and road in the city over the next 25 years. So we would hope to get to the majority of them and the significant ones, but it is unlikely that we would run out of projects before the 25 years is up.
Representative Barr, thank you. Other questions? Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you answered one of my questions. So based on your current sales figures, you figure you would raise about $7 million a year. I was wondering if you could tell me, in relationship to this additional revenue, if what the size of the Duluth City budget is and how much of that budget is derived from local government aid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hertoff, our overall city budget is somewhere in the range of $250 million. Our general fund budget is approximately $84 million. So relative to our general fund budget, it would be 8.5% of our general fund budget at $7 million a year.
Representative Hertoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, my question was how much of your annual budget is LGA?
Mr. Montgomery. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. Our LGA currently is approximately $30 million.
Representative Hertaus.
$30 million of the $250 million?
Correct. The total amount of our LGA.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the last time I asked this question of the former representative of Duluth, I thought your LGA was in 13% range or higher, so it sounds like your share is going down.
Mr. Montgomery?
Mr. Chair and Representative, when you say it's going down as a percentage of our overall budget?
Correct.
Our budget continue to struggle with our budget, and as that budget needs to grow to cover labor costs and other inflationary costs, our LGA is fixed. So the actual amount of our budget and our costs covered by LGA does continue to drop every year so long as it remains fixed, simply due to inflationary costs. Those costs that LGA money is dedicated to cover, police, fire, etc., those costs continue to rise, and the LGA does not.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So Mr. Montgomery, we did have an LGA increase last year, right? So,
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Last year we did have an increase last year in LGA.
I think there was one 2 years before that. I don't know. We've had a few of them, but.
But I think it's not as.
Representative Schultz.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think our LGA is not as much as it was, and it didn't keep up with inflation since 2002.
I think we've heard that before, Representative Schultz, and still debatable. Okay, other questions, members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just sitting here thinking, and yeah, Duluth is a beautiful city. A lot of folks go up there to visit. When you put something like this together, do you have any estimates as to how much of the $7 million is paid by residents and how much is paid by tourists who come to your city?
Mr. Montgomery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. We don't have a specific breakdown. We have 86,000 residents. We have over 30,000 people that drive in every day from the surrounding communities in Superior, and we have nearly 6 million visitors coming into the city. So we have a lot of demands on our services beyond just what the residents generate. It's hard to tell exactly who's spending what in the city specifically, but we do have a number of folks coming in well beyond just the residents that we are responsible to provide services to and police and fire protection to, as the case may be.
Okay. Other questions, members? Okay. Representative Schultz, closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. Thank you for taking the time this evening to hear our bill. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Schultz and Mr. Montgomery.
Thank you.
Have a safe trip home. With that, Representative Joaquin renews her motion. House File 3006 is laid over for possible inclusion. That House file is laid over. Next, I think we'll hop back on our original schedule. Representative Uglum, are you ready to go? And then we'll have Representative Lee after that. Representative Whalen moves that House File 2923 be entertained by the committee and then laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Uglum.
Good evening, Chair Drazkowski and members of the committee. Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment, A180758.
Okay. Representative Whalen moves adoption of the A18-0758 amendment. Discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, all in favor of the amendment as presented, A18-0758, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The amendment's adopted. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is just a simple extension of a tax increment finance district in the city of Champlin. It's for many reasons. Some of them we're still suffering from the post-recession blues, I guess, in this development. But more importantly, too, if any of you have had a chance to drive up Highway 169, and I know Representative Whalen has, well, my recommendation is don't, because there's massive road construction right in the area of our TIF district, and also there's a number of infrastructure things that are being done. So we would very much like to see the committee approve this very simple extension of the tax finance district. I have Mayor Ryan Karasik with me this evening, which he would like to say a few words.
Thank you, Representative Uglum. Mayor Karasik.
That's right.
I got it. Mayor, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed, sir.
Thank you. My name is Ryan Karasik, Mayor of Champlin. And Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here this evening, and I'm going to be very brief. I just want to simply ask you for your support for this bill that will allow us the opportunity to fulfill the decade-long promise to our residents and providing meaningful access to the Mississippi River for our residents and the surrounding communities and for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, questions? Anyone else want to testify on this bill? Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mayor Karasik, and maybe Representative Uglum. I'm just wondering why the deletion of the added parcels, and it looks like you also wanted a little bit more flexibility. Does your project not need that, or just wondering why the deleted section?
Representative Uglum.
Yes, thank you. Actually, yes, we decided to keep this as simple as possible. There is some consideration in the other body, and we're attempting to line up with that.
Representative Joaquin. Other questions, members? Hearing none. Representative Ugel, final thoughts.
No final comments, Mr. Chair. Just happy to be here, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Representative Ugel. Thank you, Mayor Kurasik. I think I got it.
You got it.
And have a safe trip home with that. Representative Whalen renews her motion that House File 2923, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. House File is laid over. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Lee, welcome. Representative Frankie moves that the committee entertain House File 3300 and there'd be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have some treats for the committee as you finish up the last few bills here tonight.
Wow, this bill became much better, Representative Lee. Thank you. And there is an amendment that you have as well, Representative Lee. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I do have an author's amendment. The A1 amendment will just delete subdivision 3 and also just renumber the subdivisions accordingly.
Okay. A1 amendment. Representative Frankie moves adoption of the H3300 A1 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the H3300 A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The A1 amendment's adopted. Representative Lee, as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The bill before you today will assist with the redevelopment of the Upper Harbor Terminal, which has been a large barge shipping terminal in North Minneapolis for decades and is located between Interstate 94 and the Mississippi River and Dowling and Laurie Avenues. The Upper Harbor Terminal is a 48-acre site owned by the City of Minneapolis, which has been used as a port until the federal government closed the Upper St. Anthony Falls Lock in 2014 to prevent the migration of invasive fish species of the Mississippi River. This closure has rendered the site functionally obsolete with respect to its original purpose and presents a once-in-a-generation opportunity for redevelopment. The unique structures at the Upper Harbor Terminal and the closure of the locks rendered the site uniquely blighted and a prime candidate for the use of tax increment financing as a redevelopment tool. However, as it's often the case with large, complicated redevelopment projects, use of TIF will require some adjustments to the general TIF statutes, and public investment at the Upper Harbor Terminal will be necessary to prepare the property for whatever private investment comes next. And we are very excited about the opportunities that this development will mean for my community, North Minneapolis, and the city and the region as a whole. And I would like to introduce Ann Calvert and Mark Winkelhake from the City of Minneapolis to describe a bit more about the project and the bill before you.
Thank you, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Ms. Calvert, is it?
Yes.
Please introduce yourself. Thank you.
My name is Ann Calvert. I'm a principal project coordinator with the City of Minneapolis Community Planning and Economic Development Department. We appreciate your time this evening, and I want to thank Representative Lee for chief authoring our House File 3300. I'd like to direct you to our handout, which I hope you all have now, because we want to use some images to kind of walk you through this, starting with the second page. And as Representative Lee mentioned, this site is a 40-acre site along the Mississippi Riverfront and is the largest remaining single-owner development opportunity along the river in Minneapolis. And while this site has a lot of assets, and you see some of them listed there, it also has some unique project needs that we're going to need some assistance with in order to get the site redeveloped. On page 3, you can see an aerial that shows where the site is within the context of the city. We're looking down the Mississippi River to the south towards downtown Minneapolis, and the site is outlined in red there, and it is within Representative Lee's district in North Minneapolis, which is on the right side of your image, and then on the left side, for those of you who know the area, that's Representative Loeffler's district right across the Mississippi River. Then on page 4 is an aerial that looks right down at the site. You can see the site outlined in green there, and the river, and then it is between the Mississippi River and Interstate 94, both of which go basically north-south. Dowling is the main access point to the site, and it goes east-west, and as does Lowry Avenue, which is just below the site to the south. page 5 is where we have some images to help you do a little virtual tour of the site, and you get a sense of what some of the unique industrial architecture is that is left on the site after its operation as a barge shipping terminal. You see a lot of structures that are all in very poor condition. You see we have rail spurs that are no longer used. We have deteriorated roads. We have a few roads in the area. They're all in really terrible shape, and there aren't many of them. And then I note that several of the pictures, and shows up best in the upper right-hand corner, you can see the towers for our overhead power transmission line that are another complication on the site. And then the next page has a couple of maps that illustrate this one particular challenge, which is the power line. And you can see in yellow on the left is the existing line. And this is an overhead transmission line that goes from the Riverside plant to downtown Minneapolis. And it can't be removed. It needs to be there to serve downtown Minneapolis. But you can see it goes right through the middle of most of the site. And with the easement that's underneath it, it really severely limits what we can do on the site. So we are looking at ways we can relocate it. And you see on the right one of the options for how it could be maybe relocated to one side of the site, so that we can free up the site for redevelopment. But this is probably going to cost us several million dollars and is an example of one of the unique challenges we have. We anticipate that this redevelopment project, given 48 acres, it's going to happen in multiple phases over multiple years and probably multiple tax increment districts as different phases are ready to go. We have this tax increment financing request, and then we also have a bonding request with this Minneapolis Park Board, where we're seeking funds to help with the site preparation, including stormwater management, parks, river wall retention, and the construction of the roads and the utilities. The city and the park board together have selected a development team, and we've been working very hard with them on the plan for what we're going to build on the site. And we hope that will be a combination of riverfront parkland with some housing, some commercial development. There's discussion of a performing arts center. But no matter what we do, we are going to need to move that power line, build the roads, build the utilities, and that sort of thing. So I'd be happy to answer questions about the site. Otherwise, I'll turn it over to Mark to walk you through what the bill includes.
Okay, let's move to the next testifier, and then we'll do questions. Okay. Welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself for the record. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Mark Winkelhake, the Director of Development Finance with the City of Minneapolis. I'd like to walk you through the bill and describe the various provisions and why they're needed. It's summarized on page 7 of your handout. The starting subdivisions 1 and 2 in the bill would allow the City of Minneapolis to create one or more redevelopment TIF districts on the Upper Harbor Terminal parcels without having to meet the typical qualification requirements in the TIF statute, or as most of you know, referred to as the TIF Act. So the first provision is needed because most of these parcels in the Upper Harbor Terminal project are very unique in nature. For example, the TIF Act talks about substandard buildings. However, many of the structures out on the Upper Harbor Terminal site do not technically qualify as buildings. So there's grain elevators, storage domes, a variety of other structures that are not technically buildings. However, all of them are in very poor shape, as you can see from some of the photos. Another example is that the TIF Act requires a significant amount of land has to be occupied by various improvements like buildings, streets, and parking lots. A large portion of the Upper Harbor Terminal, though, was used for outdoor storage of bulk material, and the underlying land does not have traditional improvements on it. So it's some combination of paving, gravel, and dirt. The large overhead transmission lines that Ann mentioned are also a unique blighting influence on the site, and the TIF Act does not specifically talk about that. And finally, the closure of the lock and dams rendered the Upper Harbor Terminal site obsolete with respect to its intended use, and the city considers the entire site to be significantly blighted. Subdivision 3 was deleted by the author's amendment. Redevelopment of the site is certainly going to take longer than 5 years. So subdivision 4 of the bill extends the time period within which each TIF district must incur all of its in-district financial obligations, and that time period is being extended from 5 years to 10 years. This would allow more flexibility in structuring the tax increment bonds and the notes that the city is ultimately going to have to issue in order to finance all these public improvements. Subdivision 5 would allow tax increment, if needed, to be spent outside the boundaries of the TIF districts, often referred to as pooling, in order to pay for the utilities, the roads, and the relocation of this major power line. These public improvements would need to be incurred within the North Washington Industrial Park project area that's located north of Lowry Avenue, as shown in the yellow area on page 8 of your handout. So this pooling flexibility is extremely important in order to pay for these major site improvements that cannot be done incrementally. So as an example, moving the power lines or constructing these roads and utilities is most efficiently done all at one time or in large segments, which span multiple projects and quite a distance here. The map on page 8 shows the Upper Harbor Terminal parcels in the crosshatched area. The roads that would need to be improved or constructed are shown in red, and the power line that would need to be moved is shown in orange. As you can see, these infrastructure projects span, as I mentioned, multiple parcels, and also the roadways that are adjacent to them. This site represents a great opportunity for the city of Minneapolis, but it's very complicated and challenging. Tax increment financing will be a critical tool to finance the needed public improvements, but some flexibility in the provisions of the TIF Act are vitally important. We know that some of these provisions in the bill may need to be modified moving forward, and we are happy to continue the discussion with committee members. Thank you again for the opportunity to be here today, and we're happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Winkelhake.
Hey.
Okay, Mr. Winkelhake, could you describe for us again, kind of from the map on page 8, where you'd be able to change the pooling authority to?
Well, you know what? First of all, I'd just like to start out by saying with these large redevelopment phase projects, you always run into the situation of do you try to create one big one or multiple small ones. And no matter which way you choose, you run into some of the provisions of the TIF Act. But to answer your question more specifically, the districts themselves would be located right around or on the cross-hatched areas. That's where they have to be located, on the cross-hatched areas. The increment would be spent more than likely right around where the red lines are or the orange line is. So that's roads and power line reconstruction and utilities. We chose this project area, the larger yellow, because it already exists, but there's no intention for the increment, for instance, to be spent way up on the north side of the project area.
Okay. Other questions, members?
Yeah.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair and members, I'm familiar with this Northern Harbor site and was involved with some of the building of it more than 30 years ago, some of the improvements. But this is a great opportunity for this area of Minneapolis to jumpstart new redevelopment and kind of revitalize that area. So thanks for bringing this forward. If you get this TIF district approved, one of the handicaps of a larger site like this is all this demolition that has to be done in the first phase, really, to start to lure potential development into the area. But if you get this TIF district approved, is it true that this large storage dome will be repurposed into an IMAX theater?
You wish.
Ms. Colbert, that's for you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we've had a lot of interesting ideas, but that is not one of them. We are looking at possibly saving a couple of the domes because they are so unique. And so we might be looking for uses for a couple of them. But we hadn't thought about an IMAX theater. But if there's a developer out there who wants to make that happen, we can talk.
Ms. Colbert, do they float?
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering what was in the treats.
I told you the bill got better, Ms. Colbert.
Mr. Chair, the domes definitely would not float.
Okay, Representative Hertaus.
Well, thank you for that, and of course I was kidding, but tear them down and get rid of them, and it'll just be a pit for money in the future.
Okay, other questions, members? Representative Anderson.
Just a quick question, Mr. Chair. When the testifiers mentioned bulk commodities stored outside and all of our talk, and I see the river right there, do they have containment facilities around them, these mounds of whatever, if they were stored outside?
Ms. Culver?
Mr. Chair, Representative, most of them are things like aggregate and stuff like that that don't really... We used to store salt and some things like that, but the things that would cause that kind of concern we're no longer storing. It's all pretty much inert things, or it's storage containers or things like that, that it isn't an issue.
You don't have a corn pile in North Minneapolis, Ms. Culver, do you? Corn pile's got a different meaning to some of us here.
Nitrates.
Couldn't resist. Other questions, members? Okay. Representative Lee, if you want to wrap it up, and we'll be ready to go.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for taking a look at this bill, and thank you and I look forward to your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Thanks again for the treats, and Ms. Culvert and Mr. Winkelhake, thank you for coming, and you two have a safe trip home. With that, Representative Frankie renews his motion that House File 3300, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. House File is laid over. Okay, Representative Carlson next. Representative Carlson moves to that the committee entertain House File 4218 and then laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for hearing House File 4218. With me today, I have Mark Fable from the Goff Construction. I also have with me Shane Runling from the Bloomington Port Authority. The bill before you today is dealing with the Bloomington Central Station TIF modification. So I'll provide a little bit of background and turn it over to my testifiers to get into some of the more of the details. The City of Bloomington and its developer are seeking an exemption to the five-year rule for the Bloomington Central Station TIF district so that high-density developments for the project can continue. This exemption will not extend the life or change the expiration date for the TIF district itself. It would only eliminate the five-year rule. So existing TIF district looking for a modification to continue the good works that have already been taking place. We have being passed out at this time a handout showing the work, showing the TIF area, the area in question, and then also some of the current good projects that have already taken place within the district. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers to provide some additional comment.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Mr. Fable first. Welcome, and please introduce yourself, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representatives. My name is Mark Fable with McGough Companies. I lead our real estate development group. McGough Companies is a 62-year-old general contractor and real estate developer, and we are the owner and developer of Bloomington Central Station. Bloomington Central Station is located just south of the International Airport, just south of 494, and a half mile east of the Mall of America. It's the original old Control Data headquarters facility, and now it's the Health Partners headquarters facility. And we are developing a master plan community around the three train stations. Actually, we have a LRT train station right in the middle of the property. It's a 50-acre site. We have a train station that's on the northeast corner of our property, and we also are fortunate to have a train station on the western edge of our property. So very fortunate to have those adjacent to the property. Today we're asking for the exemption of the five-year rule, primarily based on the fact that this is a project that will take up to 25 more years to develop. And the five-year rule requires all of the benefiting increment to be completed and built within 5 years. And with a 12-building, 12-phase project, that becomes very difficult to go work within the five-year rule. Bloomington Central Station is a high-density, mixed-use, transit-oriented development project consisting of up to 1,500 additional residential units on the site. Can accommodate 1.5 million square feet of future corporate office, retail. To date, we have built 263 for-sale condominiums. Lennar has developed 400 multifamily apartment units. We developed a 300-room Hyatt Regency, and we've completed two major construction projects for Health Partners and their ongoing commitment through lease improvements to the building and their ongoing commitment for the next ongoing future, for sure. The master plan contemplates building very densely around existing public investment and public infrastructure. Our ability to build densely, like in a downtown-type environment, is allowed because of the tax increment financing. We're trying to build densely like a downtown environment in a suburban location that doesn't have the same ability to achieve the same high rents that you would achieve in a downtown-type environment. So again, just to reiterate, the request is specifically just for the five-year rule only. And again, it's directly based off of the our 12 building phases and the up to 25 years to complete the project. So I'll turn it over to the City of Bloomington and Shane Rudling. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fable. Welcome, Mr. Rudling. If you'd introduce yourself and proceed, sir.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shane Rudling. I represent the Bloomington Port Authority. I'm not going to cover the details of the request because it's already been covered by the other testifiers, simply to state that the city supports the issue. Simply, the five-year rule doesn't work well for multi-phase, decades-long TIF projects like the one at Bloomington Central Station. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Members' questions or comments on the bill? Anyone else who would like to testify? Hearing none, Representative Carlson, this is a quick bill. Do you like it?
Yeah.
I like quick bills.
Thank you, Chair and members. Thank you for hearing our testimony today. Just one last final fact. You know, there's already been over $300 million with the development that has taken place within the district. There's a potential for another $600 million more. So we're anxious to continue the momentum that's been taking place on this in this project area and getting it done. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. With that, Representative Carlson renews his motion that House File 4218 be laid over for possible inclusion. Yeah. That House File is laid over. Gentlemen. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Loeffler moves that House File 3431 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I do have an A1 amendment. It just simply changes the effective date to September 30th. That's a suggestion from the Department of Revenue to give them sufficient time to implement the changes.
Representative Loeffler moves adoption of the H3431A1 amendment to discussion. Hearing none, all in favor of the amendment, the H3431A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Amendments adopted. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3431 would eliminate a unique cap that's been placed on the total taxes on lodging in Minneapolis. It's been in place since 1986 when the legislature first authorized the city of Minneapolis to impose a lodging tax at a rate not to exceed 3%. And it was for debt service and other costs related to the Minneapolis Convention Center, which many of you know is now a national-scale convention center that fills the hotels not just in Minneapolis but in Bloomington and in Roseville and St. Paul oftentimes when we get these large groups in. And at the same time, back in 1986, who knows what they were thinking about, but they gave us a unique cap that doesn't apply to any of the other 100 cities that have a lodging tax, which says that the total tax placed on lodging in Minneapolis cannot exceed 12%. That includes the state's sales tax, all these other taxes from other jurisdictions. And that was raised to 13% in 2001. Since that time, the legislature has given us an exemption from the cap when there were new taxes imposed. When the Twin Stadium was proposed and this Hennepin County had a sales tax to contribute to the cost of that, there was an adjustment made so that it didn't force Minneapolis to reduce beyond the 3% lodging tax that's authorized for other cities. And the same thing was done when the legislature authorized the county's Transportation Improvement Board and that sales tax. So twice it's been adjusted just to make sure that the amount of money coming into Minneapolis from this tax remained constant.
But unfortunately, there's been a couple of times when that didn't happen. The most recent one was actually last year. It was an inadvertent, I think, impact. When the legacy tax, sales tax, was approved by the voters, because we're the only city with this cap that reduced the receipts into the city of Minneapolis, because we had to reduce our local option sales tax by the legacy tax. And then when the decision was made to for Hennepin County to impose a half-cent sales tax as authorized for other cities, that made us reduce it further last October. Unfortunately, the timing for us was just terrible, because we had the Super Bowl coming, and as of October 1st, our sales tax had to be reduced by the per the order of state law and the Department of Revenue. And this bill would simply allow us to go back to the 3% full tax and take away that unique cap that no other city with a lodging tax has. The revenues that we generate are used to fund facilities of regional and statewide significance, which draw visitors from all over to spend their time and money in our state. And right now, we are right in the middle of the pack in terms of the percent of taxes that we have on hotels. There are other cities that are higher than us, including some of the regional centers like Bloomington and Rochester, for example, and St. Paul is even higher than us than we are currently. And this would just allow us to go back to that 3%, which has been our historic level since 1986. And with that, I have Jeff Johnson, the Executive Director of the Minneapolis Convention Center, to give you a little more information.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Johnson. Please introduce yourself, sir, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good evening, and members of the House Property Tax Division. My name is Jeff Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minneapolis Convention Center. We appreciate your time in committee today and want to thank Representative Loeffler for chief authoring House File 3431, which would remove the cap on Minneapolis lodging taxes. The city's lodging tax revenues are used to pay for three key facilities of regional and statewide significance in Minnesota, including the Minneapolis Convention Center, the Target Center, and U.S. Bank Stadium. The Minneapolis Convention Center opened in 1989 after the legislature authorized a local sales tax, local food and beverage tax, and local lodging tax in 1986 for the purposes of funding the debt service, marketing, and other related activities of the Convention Center. The city is also responsible for the ownership and management of the Target Center, which hosts the Minnesota Lynx and Minnesota Timberwolves, also many family events and musical acts each and every year. And in 2012, the legislature passed a bill to fund a new Viking stadium, funded in part by local taxes generated in the city of Minneapolis. The city's obligation to U.S. Bank Stadium include a capital improvement reserve, debt service support, and operating expenses beginning in 2021 through 2046, as well as advances for capital improvements and operating expenses for calendar years 2016 through 2020. These facilities are important drivers of economic activity for the city, the region, and the state as a whole. The people and groups who attend events often also visit local restaurants and retail. They stay in hotels both in our city and near our city, and they also visit other nearby attractions like the Mall of America and other nearby museums. According to 2015 data from the Minnesota Department of Revenue, state sales and use tax revenue reported in the city of Minneapolis totaled nearly $585 million. Add to that the sales and use tax revenue reported in St. Paul and Bloomington, and the total increases to more than $1 billion. Annually, the Minneapolis Convention Center and the Target Center are host to about 500 combined events. The events draw millions of people from throughout the state and across the country who come to town to attend trade conventions, corporate meetings, sporting events, and musical acts, high school tournaments, and dance competitions. We also host many event-specific events like the Auto Show, the Home and Garden Show. We recently hosted the Society of Mining Engineers, which showcased Minnesota's mining industry and brought 4,500 mining stakeholders from around the world to the convention center. Our city lodging tax is an important resource to us as we manage these publicly owned assets and plan for needed improvements to preserve their safety and viability.
As the cap results in an estimated $3 million annual loss, removing the cap and restoring our lodging tax to the original 3% authorized in law would restore this important tool and improve our ability to plan for the future. Over the next few years, there are a number of examples of needed capital improvements, such as a new roof and portions of the convention center, and new electrical floor boxes in the convention center exhibit halls. These two improvements alone total an estimated $7 to $8 million. Removing the cap would help us plan for the future. We greatly appreciate your consideration of this bill to remove the cap on lodging taxes in the city of Minneapolis and hope we can count on you for support in this legislation. I'm happy now to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Members, questions for Mr. Johnson or the author? Representative Anderson?
Thanks, Mr.
Representative Hertos. I had Representative Hertos.
No, he can go first.
Okay, Representative Anderson.
Thank you very much. Just some history here, if we could, the reason that the tax was imposed back in the first place, and you mentioned your lodging tax is kind of in the middle of some other cities, but do the other cities also have that when they add up all of their taxes, how do they compare with the total tax rate for the city of Minneapolis?
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. It was imposed in 1986 as a way to fund the convention center, to create a modern convention center that could attract the kind of attract business that we see now in our current one. It in terms of our comparison with others, Rochester is at 15.125%, Bloomington at 14.525%. This is the regular sales tax, all the special sales tax, the entertainment taxes. This is how you get to the maximum. And but we're unique because we're the only one of the 100-plus cities that have a local option sales tax that has a cap beyond the 3% that has made us go below the 3% that is authorized in law for all cities to impose a lodging tax that can help improve with tourism. And the reason why the cap has been a problem lately is because jurisdictions other than us have made choices to add on a sales tax that, because of that overall tax that applies to us that isn't there for Bloomington or Rochester, or whatever, we've had to actually lower it. And so this fall, our local lodging tax, the percentage was actually reduced because of the Hennepin County transportation sales tax.
Representative Anderson.
I didn't explain myself fully,
sorry,
Representative Chair. Ask about the history. Why was the cap imposed in the first place?
Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The information I've gotten from staff is they don't know. I mean, 1986 was a long time ago. And, we have no idea what the tax climate was or why someone decided that they should have a cap on it. We've just had to live with it and adjust with it because of this unique thing in Minnesota law. And I don't think there's anyone in Minnesota, Minneapolis government, who was actually involved in 1986 because the staff say they don't know.
Does anyone know?
Representative Carlson.
Representative Carlson?
No.
I don't have a clue. No.
Okay. Yes, we had the wrong representative.
Yeah, that's true. The other Carlson would know.
Yeah.
You want me to call him? I can.
Yeah, maybe somebody should page him. Representative Hertos.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, as you think about this, so Hennepin County dissolved CTIB, and I think that was effective on October 1st. Is that correct? Or something in that time frame?
Representative Loeffler?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hertos, I'm not sure when the effective dates for that was, but we did have to drop our rate as of October 1st.
Yeah.
Because that's when theirs became effective. I'm not sure when they passed it.
Yeah.
Representative Hertos.
Thank you. So we had this big event, throwing this piece of pigskin around. Do you have an idea what that cost in terms of lost revenue for not having that tax there?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't. We're actually right now calculating all of those taxes as they are coming in, and so we don't necessarily have a total dollar figure of what that would be.
Representative Hertos?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Johnson, Representative Loeffler, did I hear you say $3 million is your annual estimate of what this half cent is? And if that were the case, I guess maybe you've lost about $1.5 million in the last 6 months.
Mr.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hertas, if we were to go to the full 3%, it would be an additional $3 million a year. That would include not just the half cent for the CTIP, but it would allow us to replace the legacy adjustment that we also had to make when the voters approved that.
Representative Hertas.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, if you raise this, we're going to continue to see more and more restaurants move out into Wayzata.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, I can say that my area is just booming with great new opportunities, and I will be glad to invite you to my part of town, and we can compare who's got the best options emerging in their local economy.
We know we had good donuts here, right?
So,
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, I think that Hennepin County being able to do this, and you've listed some other cities that reside in Hennepin County, certainly seems to provide some inequality. One thing I often want to say, as much as I don't like some of the extra aid that this big, large city with tax capacity is able to generate revenue, and I read some recent runs where I think Minneapolis is getting $76 million of local government aid. You know, I think there is an inherent unfairness with just the way this was done. But I also, in the same breath, want to tell you that I'm very proud of Minneapolis. I'm very proud of calling Minneapolis my home, even though I don't live in Minneapolis. I think every one of us who drives the skyline or enters the city in the evening and you see the skyline of Minneapolis, I think most people are real proud to say this is something that we've created. And the convention center certainly has been the beginning of a very important redevelopment of Minneapolis in terms of becoming a hub of economic activity. My only lament about my sounding like I'm supporting that, I wish some of those benefits were distributed over the greater Twin City area and relieve some of the traffic congestion by not having concentrated everything in the downtown Minneapolis area.
That was Representative Anderson's bill from the other day, Representative Hertas.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
And I will just say that for some of my constituents, they wish that some of those really creative ideas I talked about earlier for local community improvements were part of what was being funded with our local option sales tax instead of just these kind of statewide unique facilities like the stadiums and the Target Center and the Convention Center, because we'd love to have some of those local community center kind of things that we hear about here.
Okay, other questions or comments? Representative Loeffler, final comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I am glad that we are going to be done before 7 o'clock, and I appreciate your consideration.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler renews her motion to House File 3431 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion.
It's a pleasure.
House File is laid over. Members, anything else for the good of the cause? Hearing none, we members, just an announcement, we are going to be meeting, I believe, both Monday and Tuesday next week, and then probably Wednesday as well at our normal time. We'll be meeting on Monday at 1 o'clock p.m. right here in the dungeon, and look forward to seeing you then. With that, members, meeting's adjourned.